third time today we have a full house. My notes say that the students from Columbus High School are here, and if they are, would they please stand? Good. Oh, wonderful. Very good. Thank you. Please be seated. The students are here on a program called Courtwood Class that we operate in conjunction with the State Bar of Wisconsin, and they get materials about the case before they come, and their teacher assists them after this. I don't know if you had time to meet with Justice Ziegler over the lunch. Did you all have time to come in for that? Well, next time, come see us again and come in the morning, because she or someone will come speak with you over the lunch hour. Well, we've taken a little bit of a look at you. Let me introduce the court to you, including some empty chairs that we have. The empty chair far in the end is usually where Justice Rebecca Bradley sits, and she is not participating, so she will not be involved in this case. The other empty chair at the far end is where Justice Daniel Kelly generally sits. He too will not be participating, so you have five justices that will hear and will decide your case. On my far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. Next to her, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. Next to me, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And next to her, Justice Michael Gableman. So with those brief introductions, I'll call our third case of the day, Moya versus Health or Technology. Are you ready to proceed, counsel? Please do. Oh, before you begin, I understand that the students may have to leave at 2:20, and it is likely the arguments won't be totally concluded by then. You should not be concerned at all, okay? People come and go from this courtroom freely, and that is the way we like it. So when it's time for you to leave, because I know you have other things on your agenda, please just get up and leave, and we appreciate your being here for as long as you can. So with that last little announcement, please begin.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Robert Welsenbach, and I represent the plaintiff, respondent, petitioner in this matter, Carolyn Moya. We're here today because this court has been asked to determine who owns a patient's medical records. This decision will affect all patients who ask others to get their records for them, whether that be a relative, an attorney, an insurance company, or anyone else. Although the increased cost here may seem small, at $28 per request, when there are thousands of requests, tens of thousands of requests or more, the cost to Wisconsin citizens and companies is staggering. There is no valid reason for charging more money to someone who stands in the shoes of the patient, especially when this cost is ultimately passed on to the patient themselves. It should be the same price whether the patient requests the records or has someone do it for them.
Isn't it really whatever the statute says, that's what we have to do?
That's correct.
Okay, so what you have to tell us is why the statute be interpreted in a way that the authorization you have fits within those who are defined as someone who doesn't have to pay the fee, right?
That's correct, and what we're here today about is to determine if a person who is authorized in writing by the patient qualifies as a person authorized by the patient. So we start with the plain language of the statute, which under 146.81 defines a person authorized by the patient. And as the court is aware, the plain language of the statute as it relates to 146.85 has been changed over the years. But currently, the plain language of the statute is in a form similar to how it's been throughout the past 4 years, since 1979. And what 146.81 sub 5 does is it sets forth a group of requesters of who can obtain medical records for the patient. And we're here because part of the statute indicates that anyone authorized in writing by the patient is entitled to get those records at the same cost. And so why should a patient or someone that they authorized to stand in their shoes get the records for the same price? Because they are the same. They have the same legal rights. So let's look how this would work under health court's argument. For example, if a daughter went on a medical mission and she needed to get one page of her medical records certified, she could go to the health care provider, she could get that one page of records and pay $1.06. If, however, she gets her mother authorization, the mother can go get it for her, but now the cost is $29.06. The same piece of paper. This makes no sense. This is not what the plain language of the statute indicates. It is not what the legislature intended.
Point me to the authority for the difference in price, the actual dollars. Which ones are you referring to?
Well, 146.83 is the statute that governs the cost for medical records.
Yes.
If we look at 146.83, sub 3F, sub B, and then sub 4 and 5.
Yes, that's, I'm well aware of those. I want the actual dollar amount. What you came up with $1.06, and then that was increased by about $28. So where do you get the $28?
Okay, so if the request is made by the patient or patient authorized or person authorized by the patient, then under sub 3F sub 4, if it says if the requester is not the patient or a person authorized by the patient, they can charge a single charge of $8. And then sub 5 indicates if the requester is not the patient or person authorized, they can charge a retrieval fee of $20.
That's exactly it. Okay, thank you.
So for health court to do the same thing, there's an increased cost of $28 simply because the patient did not go and get the records themselves. We're here because we believe that the statute has always provided those records at a discounted rate for the patient because they're the patient's records. They can authorize whoever they want to get those records on their behalf. Health court has contorted the plain language of this statute to try to do something so that they can charge more money for performing the same service.
The Court of Appeals opinion and your opposing counsel embracing that part of the Court of Appeals opinion takes you to task for saying, are you meaning that person authorized by the patient should be used, should as used, I think, 23 times between point 81 and point 84, means different things at different places if we go along with your approach. Respond to that criticism of your approach.
Well, they're wrong.
Our approach. Enough. Can you tell me why?
Our approach is the plain language of the statute says the person authorized in writing by the patient. So we look to what the nature of the authorization is, whether that be an authorization to simply obtain medical records, an authorization to make decisions about where to release the records from, or an authorization to perform any number of a host of medical decisions on behalf of the plaintiff. It would be the same thing as if the healthcare agent was acting on behalf of the patient. You always have to look to the actual document itself. So, for instance, under the Healthcare Power of Attorney Act in our standard state form, there are certain powers that are granted to the agent. There are certain limitations on the agent. And the patient has to specifically check certain boxes on that form as to whether they want to designate that the agent can, for instance, admit someone to a nursing home for a short-term recuperative stay, whether they want to allow the agent to withhold or withdraw a feeding tube. And there's an extra section that the principal can actually limit the agent further. So even if this were a healthcare agent acting under a healthcare power of attorney, the healthcare provider always has to look at what the nature of the authorization is.
So, I still want to bring you back to they're asserting it's different meanings, that phrase results in different meanings in the 23 times cited within that statutory framework. And your response is they're wrong, just look at the plain language. But
sure.
The plain language of what?
Well, for
instance, sub 5?
Correct, 146.81 sub 5.
Okay, now how about where else the phrase is used, and what does it mean when it's used elsewhere?
Well, it's consistent throughout. So, for example, when they indicate that our interpretation would allow someone to make a medical decision as it relates to release of records or a medical decision on behalf of the patient, it's not true. All we're saying is if you have the authority delegated to obtain the records, that's your authority. In other parts of the statute, for instance, where it says a person authorized by the patient may be able to destroy medical records, well, we still look to what is the person authorized in writing to do. That's what the statute calls for. Look to the nature of the written authorization.
Can we look at the exact language of the statute? 146.81 says that in 146.81 to 146.84, here are the definitions, right?
Correct.
We're not under one with healthcare provider, I don't think. But two talks about informed consent. I found that very confusing because informed consent in medical procedures means something different to me, but we got a special kind of statute here that defines informed consent, right?
Correct.
Okay. It says informed consent means written consent to the disclosure of information from public health records,
patient health,
to a individual agency or organization that includes all the following, all right? Then I get down to F, right? Are we together?
Correct.
The signature of the patient, and then here's the kicker words, right? Fine words, or the person authorized by the patient. All right, that's so far so good. Then we get down to five, which defines person authorized by the patient. You know, if it wasn't defined, I'd say, well, if you said you could do it, that was it. But we've got a special definition here of person authorized by the patient. It means a parent. We don't have that, right? Here?
In our particular instance?
You have a parent?
Correct. No, not in this case. It was her
attorney.
So
when I read this, you tell me where you fall in under the statute, okay?
Sure. So
parent, guardian, legal custodian of a minor, person vested with supervision of the child, the guardian of a patient adjudicated incompetent, the personal rep, spouse or domestic partner under 770 of a deceased person. You don't come under any of that, okay?
No.
Any person authorized in writing by the patient.
That's where we come in, right?
Okay.
There.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, I'm not done reading. That's where you come in. Okay. Or a health care agent designated by the patient as principal under 155 if their person is incapacitated. That's not you.
That's correct.
So you come in under any person authorized in writing by the patient, except as limited by the power of attorney for health care instrument. That doesn't cut you out here?
No, and that's what I'm saying, where the Court of Appeals was incorrect. And what they've done is they've tied those two separate categories of requesters together into one, and they've always been separate.
And they're saying, if I understand it, that when you look at this whole thing under five, what you're really talking about is a person authorized by the patient where the patient is incapacitated for some reason or other, like a kid, a minor. And that it doesn't, you're pulling out the words any person authorized in writing by the patient. That in five, and that's the defined phrase. So you don't usually read a definition in terms of the defined phrase. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, but I think you also look at what the plain language of the statute is. And the statute indicates, I mean, the legislature could have chosen different language for
sure.
That, and they chose to put that in for a reason, because they wanted the patient, while alive and competent, to be able to give that right to someone to stand in their shoes.
They also require that it be in writing, correct?
Correct.
So you can't be a person authorized by the patient if the patient just tells you, yes, you can get my records.
Correct. correct. They have to execute an informed consent form, a HIPAA form.
And that, oh, you have that form in this case?
Yes, we did.
Right. Okay. So you're saying that makes good sense, right?
Yes, it does. If there's a person who wants someone else to get their records, they have an interest in those records. So they're private, personal, confidential medical records. If they want to have someone else get those records for them, for whatever reason, convenience, or they're sick, or they're ill.
And personal, the defined phrase, person authorized by a patient, has a different definition here because it says person authorized in writing. So that's not quite the same as I presented to you. That was a little unfair.
Well, the overall phrase used throughout the statute is person authorized by the patient.
Right, and it's defined in 5 as a person authorized in writing.
Right, and that's correct. And what we have to do is look at what is that person authorized to do. And I think Health Court recognizes that in their brief. And they want to have it read broadly that you have to have the entire ability to make a medical decision or make a decision about releasing the patient's records. That's not required in the statute. All it requires is the person be authorized in writing to do something, to obtain the records or to make a decision about where to have them obtained from or to make an actual medical decision.
To the extent that Health Court gets more money out of these records, it reduces the costs of health care for everyone else, doesn't it?
No, because Health Court is actually doing all the records requests for the providers themselves.
Well, then it's cheaper for the providers. I mean, otherwise, the Health Court would charge the providers more.
I don't know that it's any more costly. I mean, we're talking $28 per request. The cost, and this is where HIPAA came in, is that the cost is the same. The cost is whether it takes them 5 minutes to do it and they're charging a dollar or $29, they're doing the same thing. And this was not meant to create an industry for them to make a profit on. This is meant, the whole statute is meant for the patient's benefit, not to create business, not to create a business opportunity. It's to be able for the patient to access their own records at a cost-effective manner, not for them to be able to be making profits on a patient's private medical records.
I note that it is any person authorized in writing by the patient that begins that phrase. Does that include if I were a patient and I wanted my neighbor to go get my records for me?
Yes, it would.
It isn't limited to the lawyer.
It's not limited to any certain person or entity. It's the patient's right to choose whoever they want to assist them to get those records or to have their records. It draws no distinction between an attorney, a relative, some other family member, insurance companies, a life insurance company, school official if they wanted the records. Anyone that patient chooses to have those records, they should get them at the same rate as the patient.
Well, isn't the language depend on how you read the if clause? You could read it, any person authorized in writing by the patient, if the patient has been found to be incapacitated. You read that if clause to mean a health care agent, if the patient has been found to be incapacitated. You limit that clause to that language,
yes,
not to the whole thing.
Yes, there are two separate clauses, and the historical statute shows that. Chapter 155 was enacted in 1989, and this statute before that was enacted, that language, that last part that you just quoted, was not part of the statute. It simply ended with any person authorized in writing by the patient, period.
Well, the other thing is you have a series. They're all separated by a comma. Each one is a comma. And then you have any person authorized in writing by the patient. That, too, is separated by a comma.
Correct.
And you don't get an or, the alternative, until healthcare agent, which makes it look as if defines healthcare agent rather than any person designated, any person authorized in writing, because because otherwise grammatically it doesn't make any sense, because you have everything separated by commas until you get to or, then you've stopped. You've separated all the listed people from the ultimate one.
Where's, excuse me, Justice Abramson, where's the if you're talking about in sub 5? I'm not following along, but I'd like to.
Well, if you look, it says chapter 155.
I'm just reading subsection 5. That's what you were reading. Okay. Oh, that's, I see. That's after that last one. It's after the or. Thank you very much.
Doesn't your position, if I understand it, is the if clause doesn't connect with any person authorized in writing by the patient?
That's correct.
Grammatically.
And there's a few reasons why that's correct, because...
When was the statute enacted?
It was enacted in 1979.
Continue with your question.
And initially, as I indicated, when it was first enacted, there was no language at all about the health care power of attorney, because that didn't come into effect until 1989. So if you look at the 1979 statute, it had four people who could request the records. A parent of a minor, a guardian of an incompetent, a personal representative or spouse of a deceased, or anyone authorized in writing by the patient, period. That's all the 1979 statute said. Then when the health care power of attorney, chapter 155, was enacted in 1989, this language, or a health care agent designated by the patient as a principal under chapter 155, if they've been found incapacitated, that language was added in to add in a new group of requester, a health care agent acting under a power of attorney for an incapacitated patient. And that makes sense, because while the patient is alive, they can make the decision. They can decide who to authorize to get their records for them. It's only the only time the healthcare agent comes into effect is when the patient is incapacitated. So that's why that language was added on. Additionally, because that language was added on as another category, you don't need a comma before the or. It's, you have those four groups or a healthcare agent acting under power of attorney for an incapacitated person. So there's no need for a comma. In fact, I don't think a comma would make sense before that, or it would make, I think it would make the statute read strangely. I think the or without a comma is the ordinary usage of it.
But you're talking about a comma between CH-155 and the if.
No, I'm talking about a comma where it would say any person authorized in writing by the patient, comma.
There is a comma there. There is on the copy I have.
Well, that may be the one that helps.
That helps you. As far as I'm concerned, that comma helps you, so don't.
Well, I'm looking at the actual statute. I don't know what.
So am I.
Okay.
I don't have. In fact,
Well,
isn't that interesting?
Yeah, either way, they're a separate group of requests.
So we're going to have to strike from your opposing counsel this exegesis on serial commas, then, if there's.
Well, and I think the important thing is I think they recognize that as well, and they've provided a handout today, I think, that shows that those are separate groups of requesters, and they recognize that now in their latest brief. After having argued that to the contrary for the last several years, now when we're in this court, they've recognized that these are two separate groups of requesters. They've set that out in their brief. They've handed that out for you today. So.
One of your main arguments is looking at this very language. The Court of Appeals got it wrong, you say, because they collapsed everything between those, I hate to say between those commas because I'm looking at mine, but they collapsed, you advance, these two concepts. Any person authorized in writing by the patient or by the patient, they collapsed that with any person authorized help. Any healthcare agent designated by the patient as a principal under Chapter 155, etc. Can you further explain why you think what the Court of Appeals did? Did it indeed collapse those two? And if so, what's the problem with that?
Yes, on page 7, I believe, of their decision, they've set forth their reading of the statute, and they have set forth on page 7 as sub 5. they've combined those two, and they indicate that the statute says a person authorized by the patient includes, and then under sub 5, they combine it, any person authorized in writing by the patient or a healthcare agent designated by the patient as a principal if the patient is incapacitated, except as limited by the power of attorney for healthcare. So they've now combined the category where a patient, while they're alive and competent, can authorize anyone they want into now they have to be incapacitated. And that's not what the plain language of the statute says. It's not what the legislature intended. And Health Board recognizes that.
We'll ask Health Court if they recognize.
One of the arguments that Health Board has raised is about the recent amendment to the statute, which I'm sure you'll want to know our position on is. And frankly, our position is that it didn't change the plain language of the statute. And under the Kalal case, we look always to the primarily to the plain language of the statute. And that language has not been altered, changed, or removed in any way. In fact, the recent amendment indicated, notwithstanding that language, a public defender is going to be recognized as a person authorized as long as they have informed consent of the patient. So that goes to show that Health Board's argument that the person who is authorized by the patient has to be able to make a medical decision, that's an incorrect argument, because now you have a situation where, if we believe Health Board's argument, now the public defender is the only one who doesn't have to be able to make a medical decision or a decision, be able to make a decision about where to release those records from. Under the current statute as amended, the public defender is given informed consent. They don't decide where to release the records from. That's always with the patient. The patient decides what facility to release the records from, provides the informed consent to the public defender, and now they get the records at the same rate. So, first of all, we believe the plain language is clear that authority of the patient to allow someone else to stand in their shoes to get the records at the same rate still exists, hasn't been changed. And I think if you look at the reason for the amendment, you had a state agency who couldn't get the records for the fees that they were to be charged. And so the easy solution for them, the state agency, was to come to the legislature to get that fixed. The solution for Ms. Moya was to file an action with the court as a private citizen. So we don't believe that the recent amendment has done anything to change the plain language of the statute. The authority is still there for the patient to authorize anyone else to stand in their shoes to get those records at the same rate.
Thank you, Councilor.
Thank you.
So if you want to wait just a minute, I think our students are needing to leave, so then you won't be hearing them go out the back. So we let them get out the back before you begin. I assume that this is opposing counsel has seen this, correct? No problem with it, counsel? Okay, all right. Please begin with your argument.
Good afternoon, Madam Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court. It's an honor to be here representing Health Court, Inc. and Aurora, who I will collectively refer to as Health Court. I am John Frankie, and along with Dan Manna, are here on behalf of the defendants. A plain language argument that simply assumes the addition of a clause with no other basis is not a plain language argument at all, and that's the argument that plaintiffs have asserted in this case. They contend that the plain language has an obvious meaning, but only do so by adding additional language without any reason given to the court as to why that language should be added.
What's the additional language?
The additional language is the assumption that a person authorized in writing by the patient includes any person authorized in writing to receive health care records. That's the assumption.
Oh, so the added language is to receive. Any person authorized in writing to receive health records. That's what you want to add.
That's the assumption that the plaintiffs have indulged in and added in support of their interpretation of the statute.
But they would respond and say, but you have instead added language. Any person authorized in writing by the patient to consent to the release. So I just pause to say your opposing counsel is arguing plain meaning. You're arguing plain meaning. The Court of Appeals in paragraph 11 says we start with the plain meaning, and they collapse these two categories that have been the focus of our attention in sub 5. You, and what you just handed out, don't collapse them. Your opposing counsel doesn't collapse them, the Court of Appeals, and everyone says it's plain.
This may not be the first time you've had an instance where opposing sides have claimed plain meaning and arrived at completely opposite conclusions, but the difference here...
And they add different language.
They add to, you said they add to, what was it, to examine, or I'm sorry?
To receive, is
to
what
receive,
he said.
To receive, thank you. And they say you add... to consent to release.
Yes.
You know, I'm looking at 3F under 83, and I read paragraph A to say that if a person requests copies of the health care records, provides informed consent, and pays the applicable fees under B, the person making the request is given copies of the records. So how do you say that's not receiving copies of the records?
It is receiving copies of the records, but the question that has to be answered, that the plain words of the defining clause don't answer, is authorized to do what?
Well, every statute's a little different. There's another statute where it talks about, let me just tell you which one I'm looking at so we can look at it together. I think it's 82.5C1, and there it says the patient or a person authorized by the patient provides informed consent for redisclosure. So that person has to provide more than a HIPAA release. They have to have shown informed consent for redisclosure. I mean, you can do a lot of things, but I think that sub 5 just says who is defined as this person, not what that person can do. Why am I wrong on thinking the definition only defines the person, not what that person can do?
You're absolutely correct. The statute defines who falls within those five words,
right,
person
agree.
Authorized by the patient.
Right.
The confusion may come because part of the way they do that is to add in their lengthy definition eight words that say person authorized by the patient includes any person authorized in writing by the patient. But the chore, the task still becomes taking those five words, whenever the defined term is used 22 times throughout the statute, and apply a consistent meaning. And to do that, one has to answer the question, authorized to do what?
Why? Why? If we got 22 different statutes, maybe they're doing 22 different things in 22 different statutes. I didn't look them all up, but...
Because otherwise, the group of people defined by person authorized by the patient would become far larger than the legislature clearly intended. If it includes authorized to do anything, we have to decide some limit on that. We're dealing with a set of statutes that govern the obtaining of health care records. So presumably, we're not talking about a patient who's authorized someone to talk to the IRS. We're not talking about a patient who's authorized someone to remodel their kitchen. We're obviously
talking... Or to make a healthcare decision about whether they should be intubated or whether they should be fed if they're having some particular kind of healthcare concern.
And Yes, that is exactly what we're talking about. And the people that you just referred to, Chief Justice, are people who truly stand in the shoes of the patient. And I can see three different types of authorizations that one can come up with as they look at this group of statutes. But my premise is that to give this phrase meaning, you have to decide authorized to do what? Authorized to do anything? Authorized to make healthcare decisions on someone's behalf, including deciding on the release of records? Or is it broader than that? And the plaintiffs have suggested that it's not only broader than that, it's a great deal broader than that. And they turn to the informed consent concept, which we've all become familiar with in a lot of different concepts, the HIPAA authorization. But when we talk about authorizing, I think it's important to keep in mind that the statute we have on informed consent doesn't use the word authorized. It talks about consent to have one party, someone with your health care records, give those records to somebody else. So we have, if we want to talk in terms of authorization, which the statute does not use, we could say that informed consent authorizes a health care provider, your doctor, your doctor's office, to give your records to someone else. Now, is that someone else someone authorized by the patient? In a sense, they are, but they clearly don't stand in the shoes of the patient. All they have been given is the right, because your doctor's authorized to give them records, to hold out their hands and accept the records. That's not standing in the patient's shoes to simply receive a copy of records. When the personal injury lawyers sue a defendant, that defendant often gets authorizations to get the plaintiff's records. The defendant doesn't stand in the shoes of that plaintiff in any meaningful way. They simply have been designated in a HIPAA form to be able to get the records.
Well, isn't that what happened here? Didn't the attorney get the record based on a HIPAA form?
Yes.
Okay.
You know, the test, a definition and its application in the statute is everywhere the phrase is used, you can put in definition. So if you're talking about the informed consent, subsection 2 under 146A1, F says the signature of the patient or the patient authorized or the person authorized by the patient. Okay. Person, so we should be able to substitute there for person authorized by the patient the words any person authorized in writing by the patient. Now, you would say no, that's not right. Is that right?
It is right as a matter of the exact words, but it certainly doesn't include someone who is simply able to get records.
Hey, all we have to do is substitute the definition for the defined phrase. So what would you substitute for the words or the person authorized by the patient in F?
I wouldn't substitute anything. I would say that the group of people identified by that defined phrase gets to have this right. But this is a perfect example of the absurdity that would result if you accept the plaintiff's interpretation, because then you would be substituting in for those words any person authorized to receive records.
It's authorized in writing by the patient. So an informed consent means written consent to the disclosure of information from patient health records to the following: person authorized by the patient, right? And that would include any person authorized in writing by the patient can get information, right?
If they're authorized to receive records, yes, they can get it. But if you look at part F of that definition, the informed consent definition, it says that the form needs to be signed by a person authorized by the patient.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be signed by either the patient or a person authorized by the patient. If you accept plaintiff's interpretation, that a person authorized by the patient includes someone who is able to receive the records, then what you've done is create a definition that allows that same person to turn around and authorize the release of your health care records.
But you agree that if it's authorized by the patient, they can get all the information, right? That's what 2 says.
Subsection 2, what subpart of it?
Yeah, informed consent means written consent to the disclosure of information.
So yes, they have the right to get the records. But the starting point for our issue here is who gets to be charged these extra fees? What set of people gets to be charged the extra fees, not who gets to receive records? And the answer to the question, who gets to be charged these extra fees, requires application of this defined term, person authorized by the patient. If that class of people, person authorized by the patient, includes anyone who has been told you can release my records, or anyone who has been told you can receive these specific records, then every time that phrase is used throughout the statute, this large set of people would be able to act in the shoes of the patient. And clearly that's not what should happen in this instance. And clearly a person who's simply been given the right to receive your records doesn't qualify as the set of people who can turn around and authorize the release of your records to somebody else. That is the result of plaintiff's interpretation.
Except I thought in part that was the result of your interpretation, your contextual interpretation. You look at sub 5 of 14681. Persons authorized by the patient means the following. And I understood in part your contextual argument is that all of these people are able to authorize the release of documents. Maybe I misunderstood.
Yeah, absolutely. All of those people are people who are truly able to stand in the shoes of the patient, not simply someone who can get a discrete set of records, maybe one page, maybe 1,000 pages, but a discrete set of records. That isn't someone who stands in the patient's shoes. Otherwise, it would include the defendants a plaintiff sues who are given authorization to get records. That's all they have been allowed to do, is receive the records. They have not been elevated to this important status of the defined term. And this is a statute, after all, that's concerned with the confidentiality of our healthcare records and the limited disclosure. And it is essential that that phrase be interpreted narrowly and reasonably.
And thus interpret in sub 5 this area that we're looking at in terms of defining person authorized by the patient. We define it as any person authorized in writing by the patient. And you, because of the context of the other entities named, would say that that means any person authorized in writing by the patient to release records. That's what I understood your contextual argument to be.
It includes any person who's been authorized to make medical decisions for the plaintiff, for the patient, including the release of records.
I spoke in too much of an abbreviated fashion. It should be any person authorized in writing by the patient to consent to the release. Am I more
Yes, that is our contention. That's what the Court of Appeals concluded. And as I believe has been pointed out, it follows logically, if not inexorably, from the context of the use of this phrase. It includes all the other times this phrase is used. The initial context is the context of the definition, which all includes people who have authority to release records, people who have authority over the medical decisions for that patient, not some vast group of people who simply have been handed an informed consent at some point. It includes the important state public defender amendment. It includes the 22 times the statute is the defined phrase is used. And in our brief, we pointed out not just under the informed consent statute where you get an absurd result, where someone who has the right to get your records now has the right to sign an informed consent, But there are other examples, each of the times that this phrase is used, that would lead to all sorts of problems, or at least would lead to absurdities. I think the second example we gave is a notice requirement. It's the second time the statute, the phrase is used. It's 0.819 sub 2 sub A, and it requires healthcare providers who are ceasing practice or going out of business to give written notice to a patient or, here's the defined term, person authorized by the patient, about whether records are going to be maintained or destroyed. Now, if you take that, those five words, the defined term, and you include everyone who ever had a HIPAA authorization, Mr. Welsenbach has argued that, a healthcare provider going out of business could send notice of that to Mr. Welsenbach or to the defense attorney who got a HIPAA authorization. It clearly is intended to be an important and narrow group of people. We're not simply defining this term to decide who ought to pay extra fees. And I'd be glad to discuss what makes sense in terms of the decision the court makes about the statute and who pays the fees. We're talking about a defined term, however, that is used in many different ways and has to be used the same way every time. And as Justice Walsh Bradley noted, the Court of Appeals picked up on this. It's not that it's used differently each of the 22 times. It's that the plaintiff's argument appears to be that it's used in one way in the fee statute and a different way everywhere else.
Counselor, I would like you to look with me at 146, 82, 5, C, 1. That section says the patient...
I'm sorry, Justice. 146.
Yep, 5, C, 1.
This is on redisclosure.
Yep, on redisclosure. 5, C, 1.
I missed the beginning of the statute, perhaps.
Okay, all right.
146, 82, 5, C, 1.
And it involves redisclosure under subpart. So I thought part of your argument was that it was defined differently here because if a person authorized by the patient simply meant any person authorized in writing by the patient, that would give too broad a power. And here, sub 1 seems to say the patient, and this is when we're talking about redisclosure. So you can get redisclosure under one of the following circumstances. One of them is the patient, and leave out the next phrase, provides informed consent for the redisclosure. Under the same section, putting back in what I took out, it would say a person authorized by the patient provides informed consent for redisclosure. Why shouldn't I give opposing counsel's argument credence that I have to look at what the patient has authorized in writing, but it doesn't change the definition of who is a person authorized by the patient? Am I making, it's a compound, double compound question, but if you can follow me, I'd appreciate it.
We did not use this as an example, although I think it fits what I said before. If you take those five words and plug in the plaintiff's interpretation, you have precisely the same difficulty, if not absurdity, of having, you would insert someone who has been given a HIPAA authorization, now providing informed consent. And again,
What the definition of the statute is any person authorized in writing. Statute doesn't say anything about HIPAA. That they used a HIPAA form here, I don't think is how you define the statute. I'm worried about the words in the statute and defining them for other folks that may have different forms they use for providing medical records, for lawyers, for someone who's taking care of a person, or just for convenience. I mean, I could write on a sheet of paper that I'm going to give John Frankie consent to the release of all of my medical records and address it to, I don't know, my physician. And you could take it there, and you should be able to use it to get copies of my medical records, right? Then have to be
absolutely
on a form. Right.
But nothing about that would elevate me to the statutory definition that is at the heart of the plaintiff's case.
Why not? Aren't you a person then authorized by me in writing?
If we allow the use of the word authorization there, and I don't want to quarrel about that, if we call that authorization, yes, I have authorized you to receive records. Mm-hmm. I haven't authorized you to do anything else.
Right, I agree with that.
And
just authorize, it's just a definition, authorized in writing by the patient. It doesn't say authorized to do what. I agree with you.
But because the 8 words that include in writing appear, they only really appear, I believe, in the definition.
Right.
Everywhere else in the statute, it's the 5 words. It's right. The defined terms in the statutory scheme. So when we talk about authorized in writing, we're talking about what group of people covered by that 8-word phrase, authorized in writing by the patient, mm-hmm. are going to be allowed to be a part of the definition of the important defined term, that group of people who truly stand in the shoes of the plaintiff, who are persons authorized by the patient. So the authorized in writing doesn't have to be interpreted under 146.82 sub 5. It doesn't have to be interpreted every time the defined phrase is used. It needs to be interpreted in the definition. It needs to be the starting point.
I agree.
And our contention is, and the Court of Appeals completely agreed, that all of the context of this indicates that it cannot mean and does not mean any person authorized to accept records, any person who's the designated recipient of records. It means a much narrower set of people. And that context is provided by the definition itself, by the way that the language is used. And perhaps the most convincing context is that we have the unusual situation where the legislature has recently put its stamp of approval on this interpretation. The legislature has decided what this means, and it's really incumbent to accept the legislature's decision, because there is no other way to explain the state public defender amendment.
You're talking about the notwithstanding language?
I am. The state public defender's office sought, and the legislature granted, precisely the same relief that Ms. Moya's personal injury lawyer seeks in this case, to be someone who is excused from paying the certification and retrieval fees. The plaintiff's interpretation is asking the court to conclude that the state public defender's office and the legislature did not know what they were doing. They went all to the trouble of enacting this new law that was completely unnecessary because, according to plaintiff's argument, the plain language of the statute says that public defenders never had to pay this fee in the first place. In fact, the argument is that anyone with consent to obtain records never had to pay these fees in the first place. And under that view of the law,
didn't it have to be in writing? And isn't the public defender's argument that they don't want to have to get writing in every instance?
The state public defender's position apparently was that for a variety of reasons, including the nature of the clients they're often dealing with and the fact that it's coming out of tax dollars, that they ought to be relieved from these extra fees. And the legislature said, okay, you were required to pay these fees before. You're not going to be required to pay them any longer. Which it affirms the fact that before this amendment, they were required, or at least they could be assessed, these extra fees.
Your opposing counsel would say no such thing. Your opposing counsel would say, look at what's in Appendix 127, which is the letter from Kelly Thompson, state public defender, dated February 19, 2014, asking for this legislation. And your opposing counsel in brief indicates that, look at the last two paragraphs of that letter, that it supports that the public defender also thought they were being
taken advantage of by having to pay more than really required or necessary by the statute. And they point to, in summaries, the letter, since 209 Act took effect, the SPD has been faced with a choice of either paying higher fees than necessary or using a process to obtain fees that is inefficient and unreliable. And I'll just break and say in the preceding paragraph they say how this is unworkable, that they tried it to have their own clients get the records and it just doesn't work. Final paragraph says, the Senate bill provides a simple fix to the problem by clarifying that the SPD indeed is exempt. So your opposing counsel in brief argues that that's what the amendment is, clarification.
And as the Court of Appeals understood, that argument from opposing counsel is completely wrong, and for several reasons. One, if you look closely at the letter, it acknowledges that under the existing law, an SPD-appointed attorney does not fall within the precise definition of, quote, person authorized by the patient. This is initial appendix, page 127.
Who else?
Now, that's an advocate, excuse me, Joe, that's an advocate's language when they say doesn't fall within the precise definition. Another way to say that is doesn't fall within the definition.
Who else would be authorized to receive these records by informed consent other than those people who have been authorized by the patient? It's a pretty basic question, but the whole section here deals with you give the healthcare records so long as you've been provided informed consent and pay the applicable fees. In order to have informed consent, you must be someone that the patient is authorized. So who would ever be charged these fees?
Under plaintiff's view, very few people would. Now, they've
who listened. Could, though? I mean, by informed consent means the patient's authorizing you, it seems.
There is a long list of entities or people who are entitled to get your records without consent. Well, it's a long list. Fortunately, it's a very small number of people, and plaintiffs
but these
have emphasized
fees are
this.
The ones for those done by informed consent. Do you see what I'm saying? And in order to have informed consent, you have to have authorization. So these fees would never be charged if it means as plaintiffs say. It would render the statute meaningless, wouldn't it? Seems pretty basic, but I'm just.
It would come close to that, other than that relatively small set of people who don't need informed consent to get your records.
Except this is an informed consent, I think. If a person requests copies, provides informed consent, and pays the fees, then you're going to get the copies. That's what this section is about.
Yes.
And so, if it's as broad as plaintiffs, that's where my sticking point is, just so plaintiffs have a heads up too. If informed consent, has to mean the patient is authorizing the person. Informed consent can't be without the patient authorizing the person. So it unwinds the whole statute and renders it really surplusage, I think, if it's as simple as plaintiffs say.
It certainly would. And the plaintiff's argument earlier had to do with how the world should be divided in terms of people who pay the extra fees and people who don't. And the record in this case doesn't really allow us or doesn't allow the court to make that policy decision about what makes sense. The legislature obviously passed a law, specified the fees, and said that certain fees, these two fees, don't have to be paid by someone who is the patient or a person authorized by the patient.
Oh.
Now, the policy behind that and what makes sense is something the legislature has addressed.
Let's look at what the legislature has addressed then. The legislature in 148.82, for over 2.5 pages of the statute book, has listed those who the identities of persons and entities whom health care records may be disclosed without patient's consent. So they presumably, those would have to, since they don't have informed consent, those listed in the 2.5 pages have to pay the fee. Am I correct or incorrect?
Those persons could be charged the fee, absolutely. And whether that's a long list, fortunately it's a relatively small number of people who ever qualified. But the whole question of the policy behind should everyone pay this fee, should some people pay it, what makes sense, isn't something we can really wrestle with here. And I bring that up because coursing through plaintiffs' arguments from the beginning of this case is the implication of the notion that somebody's making too much money. Fees are being charged that are too high. And obviously, we don't have the record to take a look at what's involved in this, what does it cost, what kind of steps have to be taken to evaluate a HIPAA form, an informed consent form, how much time and effort does it take to make sure that you do not turn records over to the wrong person, or make sure that you do not turn the wrong records over to someone, and that the scope of the disclosure is consistent with what's in the form. Is that an easy job? Is that a hard job? We're not here to decide that. The legislature clearly said some people can pay this fee, some people don't. They could have lots of reasons why they limited it to this group of people who are either the patient or the person authorized by the patient. But none of that helps decide what's the scope of that group, because we don't have the policy record in front of us to decide who do we think ought to pay this fee, who shouldn't have to pay it. What we have is a very specific and a very clear definition, and one that can only be interpreted in the way the Court of Appeals did if you're going to have things work out at the end. And as the Court of Appeals noted, their conclusion, their interpretation, and the one urged by Health Board follows from every principle of statutory construction that we have, and the context is what answers the question, authorized to do what.
Thank you, Counsel. The red light is on.
Thank you.
We have rebuttal.
Thank you. I believe our interpretation is consistent throughout the statute. For instance, if you look at 146.819 relating to the notice required to destroy patient records, the statute simply indicates the healthcare provider must provide notice to each patient or person authorized by the patient whose records will be deleted or destroyed. Doesn't have anything to do with informed consent to obtain the records. Again, you're going to have to look at what is the nature of the authorization provided by the patient to that person. In this instance, that person would have to have the authorization to receive the notice or to consent to the destruction of the records. HealthCourt wants to have the person authorized in writing read in a very broad manner so it fits every instance in the statute regardless. That's not what the plain language of the statutes indicate. It indicates simply that the patient authorizes someone in writing. What that person is authorized to do is determined by the authorization itself. The authorization could, as a HIPAA release does, entitle that person simply to obtain the records. Or they could make it broader and entitle that person to receive the notice that the records would be destroyed. Or that that person would have the authority to actually redisclose or decide upon where to have those records issued from. As far as honoring the legislature's decision, absolutely, I think that needs to be done. And this becomes crystal clear if we look at what happened prior. At some point in time from 2001 to 2009, the cost for medical records was delegated to the Department of Health Services. The Department of Health Services looked at this issue, looked at the HIPAA law, and said, we're going to adopt a rule that says only a patient or a personal representative can get these records without the fees. A personal representative was defined only as the healthcare agent, a guardian, or a parent. That code was then removed in 2009 by the legislature, They reinstituted the language in 146.83. They chose not to adopt the personal representative language, but instead went back to any person authorized in writing by the patient. Had the legislature wanted to not be able to have healthcare providers be able to charge people that have just informed consent, they would have adopted the personal representative language. They simply would have said, a person authorized by the patient is a personal representative as defined in 46 CFR 164. That's what they would have done. They chose not to do that. So I think it's clear that the legislature chose to allow a patient, while alive and competent, to authorize someone else to obtain their records at the same rate.
Do you view the words information, medical information, the same as records? I mean, the records have the information.
I think nowadays when you have records primarily in digital format, it is. It's an information. I think it's a patient's
because
right to
the
their
statute,
own information.
The statute uses the words information and it uses records too.
I believe in the past typically the records were physical records that were provided. Now a lot of it is on digital format, but either way, the cost should be the same to a patient or someone they authorize. A perfect example is I have a client who is in end-of-life stage. He's in a hospital. If he wants to go get his records without the fee, we can wheel him out. We can take him down the elevator. He can go down to medical records. He can get that record. No $28 fee. If his sister, who he authorizes in writing, goes downstairs, takes the elevator downstairs, and goes and gets it, he's going to end up paying $28 more for the same thing. It's not what the legislature intended. Had they intended that, they would have adopted the personal representative language under HIPAA. They didn't do that. Justice, as it relates to your question under 146.83, the statute indicates, except as provided in 146.82, and that's the statute where all these other host of people can get the records, except as provided there, if someone provides the informed consent, they will get the records. So there's really two scenarios. Either you don't have informed consent, but you're under that statute, or you have informed consent. And that first part, 3F, just relates to how you get the records. Either you're without it under that statute, or you have informed consent. The language, however, under sub 3F, sub 4 and 5, doesn't talk about who has informed consent. It talks about whether you're the patient or a person authorized by the patient. Okay, so if they wanted to say anyone who had informed consent is not charged a fee, the legislator would have read, if the requester has informed consent, they would not be charged the fee. So what I'm saying is there are certain people with informed consent who would still be charged those fees.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you both for very good arguments for a very, very interesting and not so easy to decide question of statutory interpretation. We will break now and conclude this hearing, and the court will meet in closed conference at 10 past.